Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Darkcast Network,
where the light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 158. Bienvenidos, bitches. Buiti binafi, and thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cis, able-bodied, white dudes.
What?
No, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out, because you're not going to believe this.
What?
The news is racist.
No way.
It is. I'm telling you. It's 2022, and the news is still very racist.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
It's not her fault, y'all.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is FruitloopsPod.com, and we use FruitloopsPod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops Patreon. And you can also support our show by supporting our sponsors. So, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Well, today we're talking about Clarence W. Walker, a serial killer responsible for at least 13 murders across at least three states between 1951 and 1965. And it's very likely that he was responsible for even more.
You know, I only know of two Clarences in my life.
Uh-huh.
Clarence Walker, who's a terrible human being, and Clarence Thomas, who's
also
a terrible human
being. Yeah, married a nutbag of a wife.
Yes, indeed. So, that's Clarence. Don't trust him.
Don't trust Clarence.
Don't trust a Clarence. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I got nothing to report, and that's good.
Yeah. I'm jelly. I'm peanut butter and jelly. I'm pretty heartbroken about the recent racist white supremacist attack in Buffalo. We'll talk about this on our Patreon episode for sure. And there's so many things to touch on, not just about the shooting, but just like the shooting took place at a grocery store, and this black community didn't have a grocery store and worked really hard to get one so they could have fresh fruits and vegetables. And now this happened and it's closed. So not only is there all this death, but people are like, how are we going to eat? Like, you know, so I don't know what to say. I'm horrified. I'm shocked. But I'm not surprised, because this is America, y'all.
Yeah.
And so for those of you who are saying, you know, this is just not our country. It is. And to all my white friends, I bring this up because in my personal socials, people from high school and college are messaging me again. They did the same thing after George Floyd was killed. I'm so sorry. What's your Cash App? Shit like that.
Oh my gosh. That's so crazy.
I know. And the response is, well, what are you doing about it?
To like, change
words
things.
Are great. Yeah. Yeah. To have conversations with your uncles who watch Fox News this coming Thanksgiving. How are you going to use your platform and your advantage as a white person to not be quiet when this shit happens?
Yeah.
And the crime, I mean, this is a true crime show. The crime is white supremacy, y'all. And the victims are black people, indigenous people, women, people of color, LGBTQ, just human beings. White supremacy is public enemy number one. Period. And that's all I can think of to say right now about that. So let's mosey on over to some listener letters, shall we?
All right, let's do it. Well, hello, angels.
Oh, I love that sound.
Thank you. Mm-mm. Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm. What's in that bag, Beth?
Well, I wanted to say thank you to Hey Little Tomato for your 5-star review.
Hey Little Tomato, thank you so much. Hip hop air horns. Let me find the button.
And thank you, Michael R., for your generous Cash App donation.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And we also got a voicemail from Tanisha, aka Milk of Magnesia. And we meant to play this voicemail some time ago, but we got all messed up with CrimeCon and our case list. And this episode was supposed to drop earlier. So sorry about that, Tanisha.
Okay, here's the voicemail. Ready?
I'm ready.
Hi, Wendy and Bev. Listen. Tanisha, aka Milk of Magnesia. I just signed up to be a patron, and I also wanted to just spill my guts on how amazing I think this show is.
Uh-huh.
I've been following since truly the beginning. I am a nurse. I've been working nights. I worked through the entire pandemic, and in those 2 years or 1 year that we were on lockdown, Fruit Loops has definitely gotten me through those horrible shifts.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you for what you do.
I listen while I'm at work. And it definitely helps me get my mind off of the fact that people around me are just dropping like flies. And I kind of feel like so alone and so, you know, isolated. But being able to like look forward to something that's interesting, that I'm super interested in, that highlights people of color and showcases different cases that I would never, ever know about. it just really makes me feel good. And I'm so happy that you guys have lasted this long. And that you keep growing and that you keep just spreading the good news.
Are you crying yet?
I'm also obsessed with all of the Hamilton references.
Yes!
I've seen it twice. And I'm a musical junkie myself too. So when you guys throw in those different Hamilton quotes and lines and songs, it just makes me feel like I'm talking to my homegirls. And the cases that you cover, like the Babyface one about Brooklyn, and you're talking about Obia, and you're talking about Jamaican culture and Caribbean culture.
Yeah.
It was just so refreshing to hear, and I really enjoyed it. So I don't want to keep you too long, but
no,
thank you. Have a good one. Bye.
You too, boo. Thank you so much.
That was so awesome.
Oh, my God. That is so sweet.
Yeah.
We could not do this show without folks like you, Miss Tanisha, Miss Milk of Magnesia.
Yeah, you guys keep us lifted up.
Yeah,
sure.
So thank you. Thank you so much for supporting us. Just quick note. I know you're on Podbean. I think I emailed you, Milk of Magnesia. Get out of that Podbean, girl. Just get away. We'll be over on Patreon waiting for you.
Yeah.
But that was really, I really am welling up.
Yeah. really nice.
Yeah, it's a challenging time, I think, for
it really is.
People,
all of us.
So, yeah. And just thank you for being a nurse and saving everybody's lives.
Yeah,
good God, girl, thank you. Okay, so now we've got to get into Patreons. Yeah, we got donations on the Cash App. We got Ko-fi donations. So just want to thank. Okay, so we got Heather, Michaela, Michael M, and Tambra. And Tambra, by the way, like Milk of Magnesia, has been a supporter on Podbean as a patron.
Yeah.
And Tambra has been a supporter since like day one.
Yeah.
But she heard the call and she's made the switch and we're so, so grateful.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Hear all your tunes. Hip hop air horns right now before I forget. Okay. Here comes the story of a fruity Heather. The one who gave our pod more cheddar. But something that we never done. Put on a true crime pod with Heather. We gonna be the champions of the world. That's my Bob Dylan impression.
Right on.
Thank you very much, Heather. Okay.
Thank you, my girl, Michaela, in your ear. Time for Michaela, girl, you hear? I'm thinking Michaela in the air. Thank you, Michaela, girl, you're here.
That was my Craig Mack impression. Let's see.
A lot of impressions today.
This is my Heavy D impression.
Okay.
We got nothing but love for you, Michael.
Uh-huh. We got nothing but love for you. Yeah, whatever. And Tambor, this is for you. And we don't care about the racists, murders, and the rapists. All we care about is Tambor. Tambor, baby, we thank you. Tambor, we thank you. Okay, that is enough of those tunes. Hip hop air horns. So those were your tunes. Thank you all for supporting our show.
Yeah,
I hope you like those. So we're going to take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back talking about about Clarence. Don't trust a Clarence, right? remind us, Beth, who is this individual we're talking about today?
Clarence Walker, and he murdered at least 13 women and attempted to murder a 14th.
Mm.
The states he was active in that we know of are Ohio, Michigan, and Illinois.
So now we're going to get into some stats. All right, y'all. Clarence Walker has several AKAs, AKA James Darnell. It's the name he used in Cleveland. Clyde Wesley Haynes used that nickname in Michigan. And another nickname he used is Tennessee Tom.
Hmm.
He's been implicated in at least 14 murders, 3 in Cleveland, Ohio, 4 in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and 7 in Illinois. His MO was rape, murder, and mutilation. And his known victims rest in power, Queens. Aretha Hawkins was 26. Annie Faye Chandler was 35. Mary Branch, 30. Mary Jones, 37. Dolores Young, 19. Amelia Boyer, 60. Diane Carter was 7 years old. Audrey Ellis, 19. And there were 5 Jane Does in Illinois. And one survivor, her story is incredible, Laura Gibson.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, let's talk about Tennessee.
Okay.
Walker reportedly was born and brought up in Tennessee, and this is likely where all his troubles began. Mm. Tennessee divides naturally into 3 areas: East Tennessee, which is often mountainous, Middle Tennessee, which features foothills and a basin, and the low plain of West Tennessee.
Mm.
Tennessee's climate is advantageous for people and agriculture,
mm.
with abundant rainfall and a long growing season. And researching this case, it kind of sounds beautiful.
It does. You know, my two favorite things from Tennessee?
What's that?
Dolly Parton and 3-6 Mafia. Now, the state is generally free from the long droughts and freezes of more extreme climates. The 3 major rivers that flow around and across Tennessee, the Mississippi, Tennessee, and Cumberland rivers, have created watersheds that cover most of the state.
Numerous groups of people have settled in Tennessee, beginning with Native Americans about 12,000 years ago. The name Tennessee comes from the Native American word Tennessee. The fact that Tennessee and many of the places in it still carry Native American names serves as a lasting reminder of the significance of its Native inhabitants.
Now, if only somebody would acknowledge the genocide and land theft.
Yeah.
I'll wait. Anyway, archaeological evidence shows that East Tennessee had densely populated Native communities prior to European contact, which is a euphemism for fuckery.
Yeah.
People who do not have their own written language are often forgotten or known mostly from the documents written by their conquerors. I'm so glad you said this. And this is what happened to the Native inhabitants of Tennessee. Most of what is known about their culture comes from writings of European Americans who often viewed Native American culture as inferior to their own. However, Culture Corner, if they had allowed them to document their histories, which was an oral history shared amongst each other and passed on 2 generations, and didn't make such an effort to destroy their culture, that wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, no kidding. In 1540 to 1542, Hernando de Soto led a group of 600 conquistadors, or Spanish soldiers, through the mountains into East Tennessee, where they encountered Native peoples. Spanish entradas, or exploratory expeditions, led by de Soto, Tristan de Luna, and Juan Pardo, came through the region between 1540 and 1567.
Entrada is entrance. I'm entering and taking this land.
Oh, wow.
So for the next 100 years, the trade in deer and beaver pelts was the main connection between European Americans and Native Americans. But the densely populated valleys and towns that De Soto had found became deserted. Historians are not certain what happened to these people, but the most likely explanation is that the Native Americans were wiped out by diseases such as smallpox and measles carried by the dirty, disgusting, deadly Spanish. I added that last part.
The Creek, Uchi, and Shawnee were driven out in the early 18th century by the Cherokee, who apparently migrated into the region after it was emptied by disease. By the time Europeans returned to the area for further exploration in the 1700s, the principal indigenous groups were the Chickasaw in the west and the Cherokee in the east.
The colonial fur trade would change the Native American way of life forever. The system made the natives dependent on European trade goods and led to overhunting of game. At the same time, trade greatly increased intertribal warfare. It also drew the Native Americans into European wars, such as the French and Indian War at the end of the 18th century.
Following the Revolutionary War, the area that is now Tennessee was actually part of North Carolina. Tennessee made a bid for admission to the Union as a state named Franklin.
Oh, imagine.
Yeah, imagine that. I like Tennessee better.
Yeah, me too.
Plus, it's based on a Native American word.
Hell yeah.
However, the Continental Congress turned down this petition for statehood, and the region was organized as the territory south of the River Ohio.
Black people arrived in the region prior to statehood. Some were free citizens with restricted rights, but most lived in the condition of enslavement on, I've heard a euphemism today for plantations as like bondage sites or... Anyway, language is important. I can't remember, but a plantation is too kind, in my opinion. But anyway, from the colonial era until the conclusion of the Civil War.
In 1796, Tennessee became a state, the first admitted from territorial status. General Andrew Jackson was its first congressman. Jackson's victory over the British at New Orleans in 1815 made him a national hero of the War of 1812. Jackson was then elected president in 1828 and again in 1832.
Oh my God, he's the fucking worst. Now, as president, Andrew Jackson was a wild racist. Yeah. Even considering the context of the time, people were like, bro, relax.
That's a little much.
you've gone too far, Jackson. So, I'm laughing, but it's horrific
funny.
Ways. Yeah.
It's a
response because I'm really uncomfortable.
Yeah. it's what's the word I'm looking for? I can't remember what the word is. I've been having trouble with words today.
You know what? I don't know. Maybe Mercury's in reggaeton again. I don't know. Everybody's having trouble.
There was a lunar eclipse last night, so maybe that's what it is.
Oh, maybe that's it.
So yeah, I'm going to blame it on the lunar eclipse.
There we go. Yeah.
So it's a reaction that we have when something's awful.
Yeah. We're human.
Apologize.
We're trying to work. Yeah, we're not trying to make anybody upset or uncomfortable.
No.
It is just what we do. I mean, we're human beings.
Yeah.
But this Andrew Jackson motherfucker, he was an advocate of the removal of all Native peoples in the eastern United States to the western regions. And Tennessee's Native populations, along with other indigenous peoples of the southeastern United States, were forced to walk the Trail of Tears to reservations in what is now Oklahoma.
Whooping cough, typhus, dysentery, cholera, and starvation were epidemic along the way. 3,500 of the 15,000 Creeks who set out for Oklahoma did not survive the trip. It's estimated that more than 5,000 Cherokee died during the journey.
Just devastating numbers of human beings. When the American Civil War broke out in 1861, Tennessee, like other states in the Upper South, voted for secession and joined the Confederacy. Losers. Although the majority of East Tennesseans remained loyal to the Union and some attempted to form a separate pro-Union state.
Which I didn't know. That was interesting.
I didn't either. That is interesting.
Only Virginia saw more fighting than Tennessee during the war. The Union Army won most of the encounters and occupied much of Tennessee by 1864. In 1866, Tennessee became the first Confederate state to rejoin the United States. In February of 1867, Tennessee became the first former Confederate state to grant all African American men the right to vote.
Wow. That's something I didn't know.
Didn't either.
That's progress. That's a step in the right direction. Yeah. And I'm here for it. Reconstruction era policies attempted to establish political and economic equality for Black Americans. The Ku Klux Klan was founded in Pulaski, Tennessee, and by 1870, it had extended into almost every single Southern state. The KKK became a vehicle to white Southern resistance and terrorism against Reconstruction.
At the end of Reconstruction, many laws that had been passed were then reversed. A poll tax, money that a person had to pay in order to vote, was enacted. This tax made it hard for many Black people and poor white people to vote.
And between 1866 and 1955, Tennessee enacted 20 Jim Crow laws, including 6 requiring school segregation, 3 which segregated railroads, 2 requiring segregation for public accommodations, 1 which mandated segregation on streetcars, and 4 which outlawed interracial marriage and sex. And segregation, think of all these, all the extra they had to do in order to
enforce
get
that.
This, yeah. To enforce this. What a waste.
Dumb. So yeah, dumb. Stupid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Constitution of Tennessee, Article 11, Section 13 reads, quote, "The intermarriage of white persons with Negroes, mulattoes, or persons of mixed blood descended from a Negro to the third generation, inclusive of their living together as man and wife in this state, is prohibited," unquote.
Interesting. But the rape of totally Black and okay. Indigenous women is totally okay.
That's all
and,
right.
And men and children as well is totally okay. No big deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
It's making
I'm fired
me
up
angry.
About racism today.
Yeah, it's
yes.
making me angry.
It's going to be quite hot at this moment after what we are just constantly faced with. And it's here. It's not new is what is so frustrating. It's not new.
Because so if you broke this law, it came with a prison sentence of 1 to 5 years. And this was not overturned until the decision of Loving versus Virginia in 1967, which is nuts. But then,
it's not that long ago.
Yeah, it's not that long ago. And then this guy who shot up the supermarket in Buffalo, he believed in that conspiracy theory that Democrats are trying to get rid of white people by bringing immigrants and interbreeding.
I feel like this episode could end up going long, but I feel like we do need to talk about this replacement theory because that's
what
where,
it's called.
That's where the that's where these laws come into place. They're so terrified.
Yeah.
They're afraid.
And this was back in, when this law went into place.
Between 1866 and 1955.
Yeah, sometime after 1866, this law came into play and was in the Tennessee law until 1967, which wasn't even that long ago. And now we have all these other numbnuts thinking the same thing pretty much.
Yeah. And I'll take it a step further. We just got the Supreme Court decision leaked. And would you believe that the women's right to choose is also related to racism? Because there's also a fear that if white women are allowed to have abortions, then that also means less white babies
less white
being
people.
Born.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's all connected,
together.
Y'all.
Yeah.
It's all connected that white men, white Christian men really believe that they have the right to control everything
everybody.
About everybody in society.
Yeah.
And it's
super
wrong.
Gross.
Yeah, So anyway, back to the story. The lynching of Black people became more commonplace. Oh, more horror
yay!
And terror.
In
Tennessee, there were 214 victims between 1882 and 1930. Of this number, 37 were white, interesting, and 177, they were probably helping or being kind to Black people.
Yeah, who knows?
And 177 were Black, and the rest are unknown. Lynchings were often treated as normal occasions by newspapers, attractions even. In Memphis, where the largest number of lynchings occurred, 18, the newspapers sometimes announced them in advance, the place and time for lynching, and they would even close the schools
so that the
whole neighborhood
could
come. Yeah.
Come on, kids, let's go watch a lynching.
It's so fucked up.
Yeah. And Black people were, of course, intimidated by the lynchings, but some still protested, which I find amazing.
Yeah.
They're incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 1918, more than 2,000 Black people marched in protest of a lynching in Estill Springs, although the white press did not widely cover the march. Other Black people attempted to protest segregation and the violence perpetrated against them.
Ida B. Wells, one of my heroes, wrote articles in local Black newspapers in Memphis condemning the lynchings. Actually, one of her friends had been lynched, and she was like, fuck this. Oh, wow. I need to tell people about what's going on here. Yeah. There were so many threats made against her life that she had to leave Memphis and move north. Other Black people also moved away from the South. From 1900 to 1960, it is estimated that 5 million Black people, American refugees in their own country, left the South to move north or west. And in 1910, 80% of United States Black citizens lived in the South. By 1970, less than one half lived in the South.
Wow. Mm-hmm. The Scopes trial took place in 1925 in the small town of Dayton in East Tennessee. This was a trial in which a local biology teacher was convicted of having broken the state's law against the teaching of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah.
Nothing new crazy. Under the sun.
Yep.
Nothing new.
The event underscored the emerging division among Americans between modernist thought and more fundamentalist values, which, wow.
Yeah.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
We're 1925 or 2022.
I know.
Yeah.
It's happening again.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Can we be excused?
Can we be excused, please? And is anybody like, how are we not seeing that this, we've been here before and not learning from
it? Not learn anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay, on with the wonderful story we have for you here. So,
oh boy.
Uplifting. Here we go.
Oh boy. Is it shout out time yet? Okay.
All right, let's plow through.
Okay. So the Great Depression, which is the time period that Clarence Walker grew up in, had a significant negative effect on the lives of many Tennesseans and was a particularly difficult time for children. As economic problems placed stress on families, many children found themselves in desperate situations. Some had to work to help support their families instead of going to school.
Other children couldn't go to secondary school since many rural areas lacked high schools, or because their families couldn't afford the books, which were not furnished by the schools. Of the students who could attend, many went hungry because there was no school lunch program, and their families didn't have anything to send with them.
New Deal federal public works programs started funding the construction of many new schools in Tennessee during the 1930s and also helped schools begin serving hot lunches to students. But it was slow going, and schools in Tennessee, which under Jim Crow laws were supposed to be separate but equal, were in reality vastly inferior for Black students.
They remained segregated and unequal for several years after the Supreme Court issued the ruling in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And this was the atmosphere that Clarence Walker grew up in.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
That was all fictitious.
You stole from my son who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
All right, so we're in the setting. Now we're going to get into Clarence Walker's early life. What do you got for us, Beth?
Clarence Walker was reportedly born on February 25th, 1929 in Tennessee, though we don't know where or if this information is accurate. We've been unable to verify it via a birth certificate or any entry on Ancestry.com.
Due to his use of pseudonyms, it's hard to tell what his real name is. It's possible that his real name was Clyde Wesley Haynes. We did find a Clyde W. Haynes of the same age listed in the 1930 and 1940 census in Tennessee, but he is listed in court documents as Clarence Walker. So that's what we're going to go with for this episode.
Yeah. And he grew up to be 6'2", but reports were that in person he appeared even taller. And I saw pictures of him and he is a beanpole.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was very thin. But he had large bones. So he had this kind of a lurch vibe going on.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So in some articles in Michigan, Clarence Walker, using the name Clyde Haynes, was linked to two quote-unquote brothers, Dennis Haynes, who was killed by a bullet in 1968, and Governor Haynes, who was charged with murder in Benton Harbor in 1970. They may have been relatives, cousins, or uncles rather than brothers. And just a quick culture corner with Wendy and Beth. In BIPOC communities, and actually somebody at our live show, an Indigenous woman, confirmed that they do the same thing in her community when we were talking about Quahog, that we use words like brother, cousin, nephew to show respect or admiration or love to someone regardless of what the actual blood relation is or if it even exists between us or not. And court reporters or journalists who may have been reporting on the case at the time just probably didn't understand.
Don't get that.
And missed it. Yeah.
Yeah. And particularly the story is older too. And white journalists were probably dumber. Not
even
dumber,
worse.
But uncultured. Yeah.
Exactly. Lacked any cultural competency whatsoever. Yeah.
It's been reported that in 1945, at the age of 16, Walker was convicted of manslaughter in Tennessee for the shooting death of a 14-year-old boy, and that he was paroled after 7 years.
Okay, so now we are going to get into the timeline. Reportedly, after Walker's release, he began traveling the country, supporting himself through petty crime. At some point, he married, but we don't know when or even the name of his wife. He served two or more prison terms in Ohio on convictions for armed robbery and grand larceny. In 1963, he was living in Cleveland. On purpose? I'm just kidding. And at some point, he was working in a garage, though we don't know in what capacity.
On November 28, 1963, housewife Aratha Hawkins, 26, was seen walking towards a grocery store in Cleveland's east side. 6 weeks later, the woman's mutilated body was found in some woods outside of the city. Aratha was a mother of 8 children, 5 of which had died in a fire in 1960. Really sad.
Mm, yeah. 2 months later, on Friday, January 24th, 1964, Annie Faye Chandler, 35, mother of 2 teenage children, was last seen leaving an East Side tavern, getting into a car being driven by a man.
On January 29th, a wrecking crew was at a house on 74th Street, preparing to demolish the building when they found 2 bodies in the basement of the home.
Uh-oh.
The bodies were originally identified in the newspapers as Annie Faye Chandler and Janice Hopper, 22.
The bodies were found found naked, mutilated, and stacked one on top of the other. Annie had been murdered days before. She had been stabbed to death, her throat slit. The second woman had probably been killed within several hours prior to discovery and had been strangled to death. Both women's breasts had been removed.
The second woman was eventually identified as Mary Branch, 30, although she was still misidentified as Janice Hopper in some articles. Investigators believed that the women had been murdered at a different site and then left at the abandoned building. They characterized the victims as, quote, women who frequented taverns late at night, unquote. Way to blame the victims.
I was just going to say, this is old school victim blaming,
yeah.
Huh?
There you go.
The mutilations to the bodies of all three victims were so similar that investigating officers believed they were seeking a single predator. The perpetrator was described by police as, quote, vicious, sadistic, a maniac, unquote.
As a result of finding the bodies in the abandoned house, the Urban Renewal Commissioner in Cleveland ordered that all vacant buildings in urban renewal areas be boarded up. That should stop the killer, right?
Of course. And by the way, I've said this before when urban renewal comes up. Urban renewal is a euphemism for Negro removal.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Anyway, they won't say that part out loud, but that's what ends up happening.
That's what they mean.
Yes. Investigators learned that Faye Chandler had been keeping company for the last couple of months with a tall and lanky black man, about 35, who had not come around since her disappearance.
In addition, a witness came forward to say that he'd seen a man matching that description, forcing Mary Branch into an older model car several hours before the two bodies were discovered. However, investigators came up to a brick wall when trying to learn the identity of this man.
Walker most likely left the area after the three bodies were found dead and linked, because in 1965, he was living in Benton Harbor, Michigan, which is located almost directly across Lake Michigan from Chicago, Illinois.
On February 6, 1965, 37-year-old Mary Jones disappeared after drinking at a bar in Benton Harbor, Michigan. 9 days later, Dolores Young, 19, was kidnapped off the street in the same town.
On February 16, 1965, the body of Dolores Young was found in a burned out building in Benton Harbor, Michigan. She had been raped and mutilated. The lack of blood at the scene indicated the girl had been killed elsewhere and her body left in the building.
In March of 1965, 60-year-old Amelia Boyer, who was white, a cleaning lady at a laundromat in Benton Harbor, disappeared sometime after going to work at the laundromat. And I believe she was the only white victim.
Yeah, and you can tell because there was more information about her as a human being,
yes,
right?
You're
right. The other ones only were characterized by their tawdry activities,
yeah,
before their death.
She was drinking in a tavern. Yeah,
Amelia has a whole job.
A whole story.
They know what time she was supposed to get there. She has a whole husband.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's
you're right.
What can I say? The news is racist.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
So Amelia worked at the laundromat. She usually went there at 4:30 a.m. to clean and returned home by 6:30, at which time she would wake up her husband, Olin, for breakfast.
That day, Olin woke just before 8 a.m. when realizing that Amelia wasn't there. He knew something was wrong. He then went to the laundromat to look for her, and he found that her purse, a dustpan, and broom were still there, but no Amelia. And the place had only been half cleaned. Olin contacted the police. He told investigators that his wife had complained about a black man annoying her as she cleaned the laundromat, and the stranger called himself Tennessee Tom. By the way, I was wondering if the other victims, if their family members went to police too.
But the police just told them all kinds of stuff, and they were like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You were drinking in a tavern, weren't you?
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway. America.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy. Days later, on March 30th, 7-year-old Diane Carter went outside to play after supper, as she did on most nights. Diane was the daughter of Robert and Verbena Carter, and she was the youngest of 5 children.
Little Diane disappeared while playing in the grassy area of her family's apartment complex. A 10-year-old boy told police that she had gotten into the car with a tall black man. After her disappearance, her family was plagued with anonymous crank calls.
Which is horrible. people just calling a family whose daughter's lost and just saying nasty things. What the fuck?
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah. On April 4th, 1965, two boys aged 12 and 15 were riding their bikes around and had found a quarter near a pine grove.
Oh.
So they started to look for more money in the grove. But instead of spare change, they found a headless, naked body.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the younger boy had to take a sleeping pill that night to get to sleep.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Oh, man. So while securing the crime scene, police came across yet another naked body. It's two of them?
Yep.
This victim had been stabbed. Wow. In the heart, her abdomen cut open and uterus removed. She was later identified as Amelia Boyer. Then a third body was also found, that of little 7-year-old Diane Carter. She was found at about 160 feet from Amelia Boyer's body, and she'd been strangled to death with her stockings.
All three bodies were found within 200 feet of each other. Despite her missing head, the first victim was identified as Mary Esther Jones, 37, via fingerprinting. Police determined that Mary and Amelia had been carried, not dragged, to their final resting place. So it had to be somebody who could carry them, you know? A bigger person.
Yeah, strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Diane had been murdered at the scene. Many of the police officers who investigated the scene at the Pine Grove called it the worst crimes in their memory.
Wow.
Yeah.
On April 5th, more than 100 officers combed the area foot by foot, then spread out to cover a square mile of woods and farmland. A partially burned Christmas card addressed to Dolores Young was found, and police then attributed all four Benton Harbor killings to one man.
All four victims lived within a mile of each other, and Walker lived in the same area.
Mm.
The opinion at the time was that the murderer was a white man with medical training because of the mutilations and the fact that Amelia Boyer had been stabbed directly in the heart, which reminds me of Jack the Ripper, who they also thought had medical training.
Oh,
yeah. I think he was just a sick fuck.
Wow. Okay. You heard it here, folks. From the OG
Jack the Ripper was
crime.
A sick fuck.
Yep.
Shocking.
Case closed. So 19 days after the bodies were discovered, Mary Jones's head was found near where Walker was living. At the time, Walker was going as James Darnell, and he skipped town. I saw the word skipped and I literally pictured a tall man skipping
out of town.
I'm sorry. I'm just skipped directly out of town after the head was found. I'm sorry. Just looking for any bit of humor.
Yeah,
this
I know.
Case.
This is a rough one, really.
Oh, man. Police received a tip to look into Darnell, but since he was black and not educated, police never questioned him.
In the summer of 1965, a woman's skull was found in a wooded conservation area outside of Chicago. All efforts to identify the victim failed. Reportedly, two police officers, Lieutenant Jerry Harmon and Captain Thomas Brown, decided to take the skull to a well-known psychic named Irene Hughes.
Oh! Miss Cleo, call me for your free reading now. So Hughes took the skull into her hands and told the officers that the skull had something to do with someone named Walker. The officers checked out the name with those of women reported missing and drew a blank.
On the morning of July 1st, 1966, 22-year-old Laura Gibson, accompanied by her friend Vanessa Harper, was at Chicago police headquarters to file a complaint against her estranged husband. Mrs. Gibson was informed that she would have to file her action at a district police station located on the south side of Chicago.
Interesting. A tall, lanky black man approached Laura and offered to drive her to file the complaint. Laura accepted, and after dropping off Vanessa Harper, the man continued driving with Laura. However, instead of taking Laura to a police station, the man drove to a forest preserve area and pulled off the road. The man then told her to get out of the car, grabbed her wrist, pulled her from the vehicle, and dragged her into the woods.
Placing his arm around Laura's neck and his hand over her mouth, he told her that he was a quote-unquote maniac. He then pulled off Laura's skirt and undergarments and raped her, threatening to kill her if she did not obey and to, quote, leave her body out there to rot, unquote.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Afterwards, the man kicked Laura and struck her on the side of the head with a Coca-Cola bottle, knocking her unconscious. When she regained consciousness, the man was raping her again. When he had finished, he took a razor blade and slit Laura's throat from ear to ear. He also slashed open her abdomen. As a final insult, he took a ring from Laura's finger, a watch from her wrist, and a $10 bill from her shoe before leaving.
On July 4th, a group of picnickers in a conservation area north of Chicago came across a woman who they believed to be dead. The woman's throat had been cut from ear to ear. She'd been raped, her abdomen slashed, along with other mutilations, and had suffered a severe beating about the head.
But miraculously, she was still alive. Laura Gibson had been lying in the woods for 3 days and nights before being found.
That's incredible.
Unbelievable. She was hospitalized and recovered from her wounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
A week later, the decomposed body of another woman was found in the woods in Lyons, just west of Chicago. She too was naked and had been stabbed and mutilated. A picture of the unidentified body was shown to Irene Hughes. She would only say the name Walker was connected to the photograph.
Only 5 days after the discovery of the decomposed corpse, another naked and mutilated female body was found. Once again, Lieutenant Harmon paid a visit to psychic Irene Hughes. This time, he showed her clothing belonging to the unidentified victim.
Hughes repeated the name Walker. Police searched their files for a tall black man named Walker, but once again drew a blank. On Labor Day, September 5th, another woman's mutilated body was found in woods just outside of Chicago. Again, the police were stymied.
As in the past, Harmon took some clothing for Hughes to examine. She confirmed the man was called Walker and claimed another victim. Harmon sent photographs of the dead girl to every police department in Illinois and surrounding states. It wasn't long before he heard back from Gary, Indiana. The family of a missing girl identified the photograph of the victim as Audrey Ellis, 19. So now we're going to get on into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth.
On September 20th, 1966, Laura Gibson was on the south side of Chicago when she was startled to see the man who had almost killed her crossing the street.
Whoa.
That would have been like freaky.
Yeah. Knock the wind right out of you.
Yeah. Flagging down a passing squad car, Laura directed them to the man who was leaning against a building. When asked his name, the man replied, Clarence Walker.
Walker was taken into custody and charged with attempted murder, rape, and robbery. During questioning, Walker denied knowing Laura Gibson. He also denied driving the car, which Laura described. When he was told that Laura had identified him as her assailant, he eventually admitted meeting her, and he also admitted possessing a vehicle of the type Laura described.
Police questioned Walker for hours about the murders of Audrey Ellis and the Jane Does, but got nowhere. However, they were able to locate Laura Gibson's ring at a pawn shop, and they learned that Walker's wife had pawned it. When questioned, Walker's wife told police that he had often bragged to her about killing several women.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That I don't know what to make of that. So there are two more bodies were found in the Chicago area after Walker's arrest, but no new murders were committed after his apprehension. Interesting.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into the trial. What the what, Beth?
Despite the evidence against him, Walker never confessed to any of the murders. The state felt that they might not be able to obtain a conviction against him on the murder charges because all of their evidence was circumstantial. So Walker was never charged with the murders, but in 1968, he was tried and found guilty of the crimes committed against Laura Gibson, who testified against him at his trial.
Wow. That's amazing. She survived and faced him in trial. What a warrior.
Amazingly strong.
Yeah. Walker was sentenced to 100 to 150 years in prison on the rape charge, 100 to 150 years for armed robbery, and 19 to 20 years for attempted murder. All the sentences were to run consecutively for a maximum of 320 years.
It wasn't until after the trial that the murders in Cleveland, Ohio, and Benton Harbor, Michigan, were linked to the murders in Illinois. It was then that it was discovered that Walker had lived in those places when the murders took place, and a friend of Amelia Boyer's identified a photo of Walker as that of the man who called himself Tennessee Tom.
However, Walker was never charged with any of the murders. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
We've been unable to ascertain where Walker is today, but given his birth date and our inability to find him in the system, he's probably deceased. But if he is alive, he'd be 93 years old.
As far as we know, none of the five Jane Does in Illinois have ever been identified.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
So now we're going to get into our takes. What do you got, Beth?
Well, this one was really frustrating to me because of the lack of information about Clarence Walker and a lot of the victims and his early life.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine that his childhood sucked.
Yeah.
And he suffered a lot of childhood trauma. I mean, that time period is just horrendous.
Yeah.
And it's reported that he killed a 14-year-old boy when he was 16. We don't know the circumstances of that, but he was in prison for 7 years afterwards. And that probably did not help.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
And as far as we know, Walker was living a regular life. He was
hiding
married.
In plain sight.
He was married. He did have a job in a garage. So, he was hiding in plain sight, living under the radar. And I wonder how much his wife knew, because he kept telling her that he'd killed women. So, I imagine she was probably afraid of him.
That's my thought.
Yeah. But I wish we had more information about that. I'd love to know her story.
Yeah, I would as well.
And then the involvement of the psychic is wild.
I know, but I love that part of the story.
Part of me doesn't even believe it.
What?
Yeah, like, really? But it was reported in more than one place. So I don't know.
So I agree with everything you said. I'm going to just cut to the psychic part. My thoughts on that, because the psychic thing is interesting to me, because I think, well, I love Miss Cleo, but she ended up being a big fraud. But I think of Alison Dubois, the medium from Tucson, who police actually did use her to solve crimes. And they made a show about her called Medium, starring Patricia Arquette.
Yeah.
And it's wild and seems out of the box and off the rails. But I'm thinking, like, why not?
Yeah.
If they have nothing else.
Yep.
I mean, it's worth a shot.
That's
right.
When I was reading the story about the part with the psychic, that's pretty much what the police officers said. They're like, you know what? We got nothing to lose. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I agree. The several traumas. Familial, we don't know, but certainly being a great migration baby, growing up in the Depression in the Deep South, subject to extreme violence, either within his home or just upon him by white society around him, it all had to be very horrifying and terrifying. Yeah. And also there's this element of, I wonder of, you know, not knowing if you'll die at the hands of a white man or due to lack of resources. So that might be a tricky thing to live with.
Right.
The mutilating the bodies, cutting off the breast, cutting out the uterus. I am not an OG of true crime, and I wanted to ask you, I can't tell if it's because of extreme hatred or disgust for the female form or some sort of necrophilia type obsession with the female form where he can get close to it without rejection, but I don't know. Or I don't know.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I don't really know either. I tend to think when bodies are mutilated like that, it comes from hatred, but I don't really know. Yeah. I mean, okay. So Jack the Ripper did similar mutilations.
Yeah.
Cut parts off and cut up abdomens and pulled out the uterus, I believe, in one of them, just like this guy did. So,
yeah.
And we don't know who Jack the Ripper was. So we can't ask him either. So I don't know.
You mean Mindhunter didn't make it over to England and interview him?
Not in the 1800s, no.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah, but I would like to know. What the fuck?
Yeah, I'm so curious. And this is another case that, so this is no secret. I don't like reading.
Yeah.
I love listening and watching videos and documentaries about these cases. I couldn't find any.
No, there wasn't any on this one. I actually had to get a book.
Shit.
Yeah, I read a lot of articles, like a lot of news articles. I went back to newspapers.com and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there just wasn't enough information. And I found a book, but I couldn't get it at the library or anything.
About this specific case?
No, it was lots of different cases in the same book. But there was like, I don't know, 10 pages devoted to this story. So I got the book.
Oh, right on.
So I'll have to
Beth.
Put that receipt in our receipts folder.
Please do. It's a business expense and it helped craft a winner of an episode, my friend, because I was worried because I couldn't find my usual go-tos were not available in this one. So I found it frustrating more than ever that I couldn't find information about this.
Yeah, I was worried we might not be able to even tell this story until I found that book. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you got it. And I because I'm curious what a culturally competent forensic psychologist would say about Clarence Walker.
Yeah. I'd love to hear that.
Oh, yeah. And the women in the story, I mentioned this when we were going through it, but they were characterized very differently. And even though it wasn't clear in the sources that Beth found and that I saw who was white and who was not, you can kind of tell by the human characteristics that they're given when in the context of the story.
The only one I know for sure was white was Amelia. The other ones, I'm pretty sure they were all black.
Yeah. So
but I'm not 100%.
Yeah. So those are my takes. Those are my thoughts.
All right.
I'm really glad we got to cover this one because A, never heard of it. B, the world needs to know about these victims and these circumstances in this context. Yeah.
Yep.
So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences. What you got, Wendy?
So I have been turned on to the Killer Psych podcast. And I must say thank you.
Killer Psych.
To you, Beth. Wait, you told me about it. It's that lady from CrimeCon.
Okay, yeah,
oh my
god,
her podcast is amazing. Oh my god.
Candace DeLong. Killer Psyche.
Killer Psyche. Yeah. Okay, so Killer Psyche, this is where I got this tip from. So she said, tell your children to remember this, and it's a good tip for adults too, but mostly for children. And she said to tell your kids to remember three simple things. Know, run, and tell. If someone asks your child to go somewhere with them or an adult asks a kid for help, say no, run away, and tell somebody. She elaborated that predators don't like trouble.
Yeah.
So if you say no and you run away and tell, oh, geez, that's too much trouble. My plans are thwarted. And another thing to keep in mind, grownups don't ask kids for help.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of that fact, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just drill that into your kids' heads.
Yeah.
Grownups don't ask kids for help.
Absolutely. And lastly, remind them that if someone tells you not to tell or that they're going to get hurt, if they tell, or their family will get hurt, to reassure them that you will protect them.
Yeah.
And use all the resources you have to do that. So that's all I got.
Okay.
So now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by or about people of color or any other marginalized folks, or any true crime good deeds. I just wanted to shout out a little gem on Disney Plus. Family watching for the weekend. Sneakerella on Disney Plus. Finally, Disney has a show about a black boy who is from Queens, who is a sneakerhead and dreams of being a famous sneaker designer.
Oh.
But uh-oh, at midnight, he loses his sneaker.
Oh, no.
Fucking that basketball player John Sally is it. He raps. That part is kind of corny, but it was really fun for everybody in the family. The cast is extremely diverse. And the music is really tight. The shoes are really cool. Old Whitey told me so. He was like, his mouth was watering. And then it was just fun for the whole family. And you're looking for a representation for your kids out here in these streets, trying to be a better white person, and they shut down critical race theory at your kid's school, have them watch something like this. Anyway, and then also Kendrick Lamar's album came out this last week, and oh my God, whoo! I am weeping. It is a fucking masterpiece. Stream it everywhere. Talk to your families about ending generational trauma, because that's what this is all about.
So, wow.
Yeah. So what do you
all
got?
All right. I wanted to shout out We Own This City on HBO. Have you heard of
it? Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, my God. It's so good. It's great. It's great.
And it also has a companion podcast. Yeah.
Oh my God. It does?
It does.
Oh my God. I had no idea.
So We Own This City is co-created and written by David Simon, the creator of The Wire, which is one of the best shows ever.
That's what people say.
You haven't seen it yet?
I couldn't get into it.
Are you serious?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
I couldn't.
Okay.
But I am into We Own the City.
Okay. So. All right. It's a 6-episode series about corrupt cops working within the Baltimore Police Department. It's based on a true story. So it's about the Gun Trace Task Force, which was investigated by the FBI and led to the eventual arrest of 8 officers who are involved for their roles in a criminal scheme involving robbery and extortion that targeted drug dealers and innocent civilians. And eventually all of the officers charged were found guilty of various crimes that included racketeering, robbery, extortion, and overtime fraud. So
wow.
The timeline, it kind of goes back and forth. It tells the story of how this all went down. Yeah.
I'm loving it so far.
It's really
good. Thank you for that.
Yeah. It's real, like The Wire was really gritty and it's really gritty. So, I just want to say you might be triggered by some of this stuff. Police and, police brutality and, corruption and all that stuff.
That's why she's the best white lady I have ever known in my entire life. Oh my God. I just want to hug you right now. That's so kind. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wow. Oh my God. I don't even want to I don't want to hang up. Don't hang up. Can you stay on this line with me forever?
We'll listen to each other breathing.
Yeah. That is really, just really kind of you. Thank you. It's a good show, but you're right. And that's really, really kind of you.
Yeah, see that it could be very triggering.
Whoo, child. Yeah. Oh my God. Tell all your friends. Hashtag be like Beth. So that is Sneakerella on Disney Plus, Kendrick Lamar's new album. It's called Mr. Morale and the Big Steppas. Anywhere you get albums, Spotify, whatever. And We Own the City on HBO.
All right.
Well, this has been challenging, but yeah. Wonderful.
Yes.
And but we have to say goodbye. So where can the people find us in the meantime, Beth?
Our website is FruitLoopsPod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
Right. So this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So till next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.